So in the last reading, there was a bringing up the aspect of emptiness, and then I in the chapter, then basically just continued on after that to wrap up the chapter, because and I referred back to chapter 12, Ajahn Amaro's chapter on knowing emptiness and the radiant mind, because he had dealt with it. So, but I thought, because we haven't we didn't get that far with his, and because I think it's important to get a feel for that Buddhist concept of emptiness, that I have to go back to Ajahn Amaro's chapters, chapter 12, on the section on emptiness, and read some of that, so that it sort of fills out or fleshes out that perspective. That's chapter 12, and it's in the middle of of chapter 12 on emptiness. We come now to the quality of emptiness. Firstly, it is of some significance to note that although the active adjectival noun sunyata, emptiness, is used in the Theravada scriptures, it is far outweighed in representation there by its humble cousin, the adjective sunya, empty. In later northern Buddhist traditions, sunyata or shunyata took on not only a central position in the teachings on liberation, for example, in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Heart Sutra, the Vajra Sutra, and the Middle Way, as in Nagarjuna's Madhyamaka philosophy, uniting emptiness and causality, but it also took on the attributes of some kind of quasi-mystical substance or realm, not intentionally or doctrinally even, but more through a subtle and unconscious reification. It became a something that is a nothing, that then was worshipped and deified as a universal panacea. This is not to say that all such teachings on emptiness are by any means false or useless, not at all. It is just to say that, like any verbal formulation of Dhamma, if grasped wrongly, they can obstruct rather than aid progress on the path. If the concept of emptiness is understood and used as a skillful means, upaya, it is clearly seen that it could not be any kind of a thing in itself. Any tendency to incline the attitude in that direction would thus be seen as falling wide of the mark. So I think it's a really important to recognize that there are, yeah, it's almost like it's taken on sort of a metaphysical quality, or a metaphysical thingness, in some of the other schools, and of course because there's a lot of back and forth, especially in modern times, then there's a lot of back and forth with ideas, so that it's I think it's very helpful and necessary to clarify what was the Buddha talking about when he talked about emptiness and sunyata. And the next quote is from Ajahn Buddhadasa, the book called Heartwood of the Bodhi Tree, and that particular book is a whole book by Ajahn Buddhadasa on emptiness and nature of emptiness in the Theravada, and in practice, how to use it in practice. Ajahn Buddhadasa was somebody who was interested in the crossover of different teachings, different traditions, different lineages, and was not he was hardly a sort of a hard line Theravada who would not step away from any teaching that except what was in the Visuddhimagga sort of thing. No, he was very fluid thinker and extremely knowledgeable. It was one of the things he went to study in. I mean, he was from the provinces. He was from the south. He went to study in Bangkok, and he finished his third or fourth degree of Pali, and then started noticing that the curriculum was more and more about commentarial literature. And so then he was fed up with the city. He was fed up with sort of academics just for the sake of academics. He wanted to go practice. So then he left and went back to his home village, and lived in a little forest nearby the village, and started. Without like, because in the northeast of Thailand, the forest tradition was quite strong. South of Thailand, not so much. So he was really hearkening back to what he was reading in the suttas, and that was what he wanted to spend his time doing, was to study and practice and really rely on the sutta teachings that were preserved in the Pali canon, and he did that. Okay, anyway. So if a person were to say that sunyata is a material element, his or her friends would die laughing. Some people would say that it is an immaterial or formless element, and here the noble ones, the Arya, would die laughing. Voidness, or sunyata, is neither a material nor an immaterial element, but is a third kind of element that lies beyond the ken of ordinary people. The Buddha called it quenching element, or cessation element, nirodha dhatu. The words material element, vattu dhatu, or form element, rupa dhatu, refer to materiality, invisible form, sounds, odors, tastes, or tactile objects. Formless element, arupa dhatu, refers to the mind and heart, to mental processes, and to the thoughts and experiences that arise in the mind. There is only one kind of element not included in these two categories, an element that is the complete antithesis and annihilation of them all. Consequently, the Buddha sometimes called it coolness element, nibbana dhatu, sometimes quenching element, nirodha dhatu, and sometimes deathless element, amata dhatu. Any questions, thoughts? Additions? Yes.
So, well, I was wondering the other like characteristics like impermanence, dukkha,
yes,
anatta,
yes,
but also tatata and
yeah,
and so on. Are these considered to be the third quenching elements or?
There would be, yeah, I mean, yes, that's a good question, because I mean certainly all of these are inclining to the Nirodha, the quenching cessation, inclining to Nibbana. So and traditionally the aspect of anatta, when it's probably come up quite soon in this, that the what the Buddha is pointing to, what is emptiness, is that it is empty of a self and belonging to a self. So that sense of identification or claiming, sense of association, relationship, ownership, is relinquished and let go, and that one can release into that quality of sunyata. But yes, those different qualities that that Ajahn Amaro mentioned, those nine, the nine eyes, anattata, anicca, dukkha, sunyata,
Tamaniyamata,
dhamma
dhammatitata, idapachayata.
Dhammatitata, idapachayata,
Tatata
and
dhammayata.
sunyata, and atamayata. So all of those are would you could draw a straight line from those to a quenching.
I think it is. We do quote that in that when there's a dialogue. The world is empty. The world is empty. What is meant by the world being empty? And then the response is empty of self and what belongs to a self.
Sure.
And Ajahn Buddhadasa, I believe in that book, The Heartwood from the Bodhi Tree, he underscores that there's a very close relationship between sunyata, and anatta. It's kind of they're almost taken as completely different qualities in later commentaries or by the way people talk about it. But Ajahn Buddhadasa underscores that they're just from the suttas themselves, they're very closely related.
And if I may, a follow-up question to that.
Yeah.
The connection in particularly between tatata and sunyata. Would you like to expand a little bit more on that?
Well, I mean, see, the thing is again, you're not dealing in solid entities. It's sort of like it's like a sense of things, so that in sunyata, one is recognizing the emptiness of everything. In tatata, it's sort of like, it's like this. It's and so not making anything more of it than it already is, because it again, because you're not trying to rely on a particular quality that then becomes solidified or reified. It is a tool or is a catalyst for relinquishment and letting go, so that they by focusing on the emptiness of things, you can let go of and seeing they're empty and kind of the kind of void, insubstantial nature. And by looking at things, oh, it's just as it is. It's like this. Tatata is like thusness or suchness. It's just this much. As Ajahn Chah uses it, sort of seeing that sense of, oh, it's just that much. It's no big deal. And that it can be the catalyst for that relinquishment and letting go. Remember?
A few readings ago, a few weeks ago, so the way I was talking about that, and I think I said at the time, this isn't the sort of categorically the way to understand it, but it's somewhat like the tone of emptiness is talking, say, with the verb to be hoti, is about being in the conditioned realm. Today is Thursday. This is Amaravati. You know, you are Anagarika Jonathan. Kind of verb to be. So it's the emptiness is the recollecting. Oh no, that's we say Anagarika Jonathan, but that's just a supposition. We say Thursday. Well, that's an agreement. There isn't anything solid and absolute there. And then the suchness element, the ta-ta-ta, is alluding to that the other verb to be, ati. So like when the Buddha says the Tathagata cannot be measured, can't be reckoned in terms of the five khandhas, he is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the great ocean. So that isness that is spoken of in terms of the Tathagata or like there is the unborn, ati bhikkhave ajātang abhūtang akataṁ asaṅkhataṁ, there is the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed. So that tatata is alluding, of is sort of referencing that quality of presence or that aspect of being which is outside of the five khandhas, or which is can't be reckoned in terms of the five khandhas. So I think Lumpur just put it very, very well. It's kind of tones rather than kind of categorical ways of speaking. So the last time I was talking about it, I said, in a way, emptiness or sunyata is talking about saying no to the five khandhas, and tatata, suchness, is saying yes to the Dhamma. That's not the categorical way to understand it, but it's that kind of pairing. And Ajahn Buddhadasa has those as sort of the sunyata, tatata, and atamayata as the sort of the last three of those nine dhas. So, but as is the case with most, you know, if not all Dhamma teachings, it's good to be picking up particular terms or phrases and sort of weighing them, feeling them out in terms of your own understanding. What could that be referring to? And so, and playing with ideas, just sort of, well, what can I refer to, or what can, how can I relate to that in terms of my everyday experience, or what things make sense to me? And so, I think later on in that chapter, I quote, there's a French philosopher called Gaston Bachelard, who wrote a book called The Poetics of Space, and he's a French philosopher, and talking about how, well, when we say space or emptiness or that can only be relative, and every space has its poetics. You know, there's it's only relatively empty, that kind of exploring or taking up the terms and saying, oh yeah, empty of what? Empty in what respect? And how does that work? So you're picking up the terms and just letting them roll, you know, roll around in the mind, as it were, exploring and getting a feeling for what associations they have. And also, as I've said many times, where there is no association, I'm like, I don't know what the heck that's talking about. And just to also not feel you've got to figure it out or fill up that uncertainty with a fixed idea. Now I've got it. Now I understand it. Just when things are really unclear, just to part of that reflective, contemplative process is when things are foggy, you know, or dark, you know, like, I can't see, it's dark. that's helpful to recognize that at the moment this is not clear, this is not obvious. So that, and then just letting things percolate over time and be explored.
And also just again to re-emphasize that sense of, you know, these are tools, and so it's part of your toolkit to have tools that can help deconstruct the habit of creating a me and a mine in here and a solid world out there that I keep being reborn into. In the Pali scriptures, sunya simply means empty. It describes a quality of absence, an absence contained within a particular defining form, rather than some kind of absolute value. Every space has its poetics. This personality is empty of self. This glass is empty of water. This room is empty of people. Well, not this particular room, but...
Well, like in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, like,
yes,
yeah. Buddha says, this hall is empty of elephants. Right. There are no elephants and no horses here. That's kind of where he starts that. Yeah. Yep, okay.
Yeah, it's very strange. And of course, there's a very long quote of that Chula Sunyata Sutta, and it's really quite important to get that feel for what the Buddha is approaching it in a very practical way, as opposed to a metaphysical statement of some reality. There is a definite voidness in some respects, but it is also shaped by its context. The pair of silences during the opening bars of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony are just silence, but the particular poetry of those silences is shaped by the notes before and after. Da 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 da.
Very good. Exactly what I meant.
Yeah, exactly. Without the glass, there would not be any emptiness. Without the other musical notes, those moments would not be silent. That is to say, the emptiness only really exists in relationship to its vessel, whatever that may be. A personality, a glass, a room, a musical phrase, it's just a way of speaking about form and space using relative language. Thus, from the Theravada point of view, the concept of emptiness is quite prosaic, ordinary. It's kind of ordinary. It lacks the intrinsic mystical quality imputed to it in some of the northern Buddhist scriptures. However, it becomes more meaningful in terms of liberation, as it is almost always used in the context of empty of self and the property of a self. If that absence is being apprehended, then the heart is certainly inclining to awakening. Phrases such as, quote, enters into the signless concentration of mind, animita jeto samadhi, unquote. Or, I quote, I often abide in emptiness, sunyata vihara, are probably the kind of sources for the later drifting of the meaning of emptiness. Originally, these pointed to the realization of Nibbana through the contemplation of and concentration on qualities such as impermanence and selflessness, and were not intended to be regarded as referring to some kind of mystical realm. Such drift is an almost inevitable product of the flow of myth-making that we humans tend to generate. However, the wise will look into this and not be drawn along with the current. And I think it's really important because, as human beings, in that sense of, as a species, Homo sapiens can be, the myth making or the storytelling kind of creature, and we love our stories, and so it's just is and the myths that we live by. So we can any questions?
Well, I think that principle of how what starts off as a sort of prosaic way of indicating a kind of very natural, practical, down-to-earth quality, it turns into this sort of gathers a sort of mythological strength. The life of Brian comes to mind.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Where there's the Brian's sandal comes off, and it's like, it's the sandal.
It's a sign.
It's a sign. No, it's a sandal. His shoe fell off. But the mind reads into it and kind of makes a whole story out of it. And I don't know how many times it's been quoted, but where this small group of people are standing at the back of the crowd and the Sermon on the Mount, and the distant figure of Jesus, not Brian, but Jesus is saying, blessed are the peacemakers. And they're trying to hear the distant words. And blessed are the cheesemakers. They kind of mishear the word. And then the person standing next immediately provides a commentary. Well, when he says cheesemakers, it's really everyone involved in the dairy industry. Instantaneously, you have a mishearing and then a commentary on the mishearing, and that becomes
gospel.
That becomes gospel. Yeah. So that... that's what we do. And I think that whole sort of drift towards emptiness, shunyata, as a sort of a nothing which is a thing, then that's sort of part of that mythologizing and colorizing.
Here are some of the central teachings on emptiness to be found in the Pali Canon. First of all, here is a passage where the Buddha is explicitly using the term empty to mean empty of self. And then this is from the Salayatana Samyutta, Samyutta 35, Sutta number 85. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, the world is empty, the world is empty. In what way, Venerable Sir, is it said, the world is empty, the world is empty? It is because it is empty of self and what belongs to a self that the world is empty, is said, Ananda. And what is empty of self and what belongs to a self? The I is empty of self and what belongs to a self. Forms are empty of self and what belongs to a self. I consciousness, I contact, any feeling born of I contact, whether pleasant, painful, or neutral, is empty of self and what belongs to a self. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is... is the mind is empty of self and what belongs to a self. Mental objects, mind consciousness, mind contact, any feeling born of mind contact, whether pleasant, painful, or neutral, is empty of self and what belongs to a self. Hard to get clearer than that.
When I've heard the phrase abiding in emptiness used, it hasn't been a reification of it. It has been exactly what that sutta says, abiding in a place that's empty of self, of I, of knowing.
Well, you're a Theravadin. It's a good sign. After all these years in monasteries.
It's sometimes described as Lokuttara versus Lokiya. Lokuttara being without self, Lokiya being wrapped up in the world.
What was that again? I missed that.
The concept of Lokuttara being without self.
Beyond the world and the world of me and mine. The next sutta employs the word sunya in the same way, as well as having many useful things to say about the various forms of liberation. It is also significant in that it is one of the very rare suttas in the Pali Canon where a lay person gives teachings to a monastic. And this is from Sanyutta 41, Sutta number 7, which is the Jitta Sanyutta. So it's a whole Sanyutta chapter, a section devoted to Jitta the householder. And there's 10 suttas. And Jitta was a lay disciple who was declared by the Buddha to be foremost in teaching the Dhamma, and he was a wealthy merchant from Savatthi. And yeah, his suttas are almost invariably really quite interesting, quite fascinating.
Yes, obviously a very accomplished meditator.
Yeah. Seriously. On one occasion, the Venerable Gaudatta was dwelling at Majikasanda in the wild mango grove. Then Jitta the householder approached the Venerable Gaudatta, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. The Venerable Gaudatta then said to him, as he was sitting to one side, "Householder, the measureless liberation of mind, the liberation of mind by nothingness, the liberation of mind by emptiness, and the signless liberation of mind. Are these things different in meaning and also different in phrasing, or are they one in meaning and different only in phrasing?" How would you feel being asked that question? It's
an interesting way to start a conversation.
Yeah. Conversation stop. Fantastic. Okay, there is a method, Venerable Sir, by which these things are different in meaning and also different in phrasing. And there is a method by which they are one in meaning and different only in phrasing. And what, Venerable Sir, is the method by which these things are different in meaning and also different in phrasing? Here a bhikkhu dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere. And to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. He dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. This is called the measureless liberation of mind, appamana jeto vimutti. And what, Venerable Sir, is the liberation of mind by nothingness? Here, by completely transcending the base of the infinity of consciousness, aware that there is nothing, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the base of nothingness. This is called the liberation of mind by nothingness, akinchanya jeto vimutti. So that's the third formless attainment. And what, Venerable Sir, is the liberation of mind by emptiness? Here, a bhikkhu gone to the forest or to the foot of a tree or to an empty hut reflects thus. Empty is this of self or of what belongs to self. This is called the liberation of mind by emptiness, sunyata jeto vimutti. And what, Venerable Sir, is the signless liberation of mind? Here, with non-attention to all signs, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the signless concentration of mind. This is called the signless liberation of mind, animitta jeto vimutti. This, Venerable Sir, is the method by which these things are different in meaning and also different in phrasing. And what, Venerable Sir, is the method by which these things are one in meaning and different only in phrasing? Passion, Venerable Sir, is a maker of measurement. Hatred is a maker of measurement. Delusion is a maker of measurement. For a bhikkhu whose heart is completely pure, these have been abandoned, cut off at the root, made like palm stumps, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. To whatever extent there are measureless liberations of mind, the unshakable liberation of mind is declared the chief among them. Now that unshakable liberation of mind is empty of greed, empty of hatred, empty of delusion. Passion, Venerable Sir, is a something. Hatred is a something. Delusion is a something. For a bhikkhu whose heart is completely pure, these have been abandoned, cut off at the root, made like palm stumps, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. To whatever extent there are liberations of mind by nothingness, the unshakable liberation of mind is declared the chief among them. Now that unshakable liberation of mind is empty of greed, empty of hatred, empty of delusion. Passion, Venerable Sir, is a maker of signs. Hatred is a maker of signs. Delusion is a maker of signs. For a bhikkhu whose heart is completely pure, these have been abandoned, cut off at the root, made like palm stumps, obliterated so that they are no more subject to future arising. To whatever extent there are signless liberations of mind, the unshakable liberation of mind is declared the chief among them. Now that unshakable liberation of mind is empty of greed, empty of hatred, empty of delusion. This, Venerable Sir, is the method by which these things are one in meaning and different only in phrasing. It is a gain for you, householder, it is a great gain for you that you have the eye of wisdom that ranges over the deep word of the Buddha.
It's one of the most awesome Dhamma teachings.
Yes. Yeah, really,
I'd like to reflect on that, those particular phrases, like passion is a maker of measurement. Aversion is a maker of measurement, and just take again in terms of bringing that into meditation. Just whenever the mind is making a judgment, this is good, this is bad, this is beautiful, this is ugly. I approve of this, I disapprove of that. Just that, taking that. The judging habit of mind, and say, yes, judgments, measurements are based on delusion, on aversion, on passion, and that puts into context the habits of mind of approving, disapproving, liking, disliking, which we do so much of in the course of a day. So just that little phrase, like passion is a maker of measurement. Pamanakara is the Pali for that. Just remember, that's the mind is doing a measurement here, and that creates space, as it were, around that, and so that that all kinds of measurement are relative. So Lumpu Cha would pick up something like this and say, is this long or short? Say, well, if you're an ant, it's quite long. If you're an elephant, it's quite short. So. What? How big is this? Is this heavy or light? Well, again, if you're an ant, it's pretty heavy. If you're an elephant, it's pretty light. And just using it as kind of everyday examples of how we use the human scale to judge the world and judge our own feelings and our own relationships. And it's forgotten that those measurements, those judgments, are heavily conditioned by human birth, and there's nothing absolute about them. Let's say, that went by quickly, did it? This is taking forever, is it? And so that the just that amount of reflection, and that, I feel this sutra is one of the most beautiful, brilliant expressions of that.
Yeah.
That's really helpful contemplations, reflections to bring to mind. We believe our perceptions and our judgments so easily, so repeatedly, and take them to be reliable and true. And there's little sort of things like Lumpu Cha would say, you know, is this heavy or light? Is this long or short? Yeah. And then, oh yeah, of course. And then it puts those the tendency to believe our judgments into a bigger framework.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just sort of reminded that teaching was. I came across some handwritten notes, and at Wat Plang when I was still either a layman or newly ordained bhikkhu, and it was of Ajahn Chah's teachings that somebody had obviously been up to Wat Bapong and then had jotted stuff down that was left in the library at Wat Plang.
Uh-huh.
And so that was one of the very first teachings that I came across of Ajahn Chah. And then the story was that a layman came to Ajahn Chah and asked him what was the central teaching of Buddhism, what was the essence of the Buddhist teaching. And Ajahn Chah picked up something that was a piece of wood of some sort and said, is this a big piece of wood or a small piece of wood? And so, and asked about the, and the poor person was just confused. I don't understand. And then Ajahn Chah said, well, if you wanted to pick your teeth, you would say this was a big piece of wood. But if you wanted to build a house, you would say that this is a small piece of wood. So it's all based on desire, and that is that's the essence of the Buddhist teachings. How desire is the culprit.
The passion is the maker of measurement.
Passion is the maker of measurement.
But pamanakara is a good Pali word to learn.
That. Okay, continue on. In this interpretation, the measureless liberation of mind is via the four divine abidings. Liberation of mind by nothingness refers to the third level of formless jhana. The liberation of mind by emptiness is concentration based on insight into the selfless nature of phenomena. The signless liberation of mind is harder to pinpoint in terms of a familiar doctrinal category. However, its characteristics seem to align it with nippapancha, freedom from conceptual proliferation, and the quality of a tamayata, the non-fabricating faculty of the mind. It is that which is restraining the tendency to conceive the world in terms of fixed and separate names, forms, and things, and which leads from there to liberation. The ancient commentary describes it as being supramundane with Nibbana as its object. It is thus identified with arahantship. The first three, although exalted states, all pertain to the mundane level. Perhaps the most familiar statement in the scriptures concerning signless concentration, as well as its most poignant instance, was spoken by the Buddha a few months before the Parinibbana. And this is from Digha 16, which is the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Ananda, I am now old, worn out, venerable, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached the term of life, which is 80. just as an old cart is made to go by being held together with straps, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up. It is only when the Tathagata withdraws his attention from outward signs and by the cessation of certain feelings enters into the signless concentration of mind that his body knows comfort. Yeah, so that, so it is very poignant, the Buddha talking about this. Because I can imagine he was, all those ascetic, years of asceticism were not very user-friendly for a human body.
Case in point, Milad. He's covered in scars as well.
Oh, only a few.
Only a few. It's also, I feel that's a very helpful teaching for people with chronic pain.
Yeah.
And that the Buddha himself, the only way he could experience comfort was to completely disconnect his attention from the perceptual realm. And that if he was in ordinary everyday activity relating to the people, the sense world and the people around him and his own body, it was painful. But, the kind of mental image of the Buddha is like a Buddha Rupa that sits there utterly sort of still and serene. But that particular teaching, I think, is extremely relevant because physical pain is so prevalent in so many people's lives, and yet the Buddha could have chronic pain and is absolutely not a problem and not be creating suffering around it. And also, from time to time, being prepared to take action to relieve it. Like yes. When he's giving a Dhamma talk and saying, Mahakachana, the assembly is still wide awake, my back is paining me, I'm going to go and stretch my back to ease it, so please carry on giving a Dhamma talk, the assembly is wide awake. So he took action to relieve his physical pain. So again, I feel that's a very helpful sort of guideline for people with chronic pain, painful feelings, that being equanimous with pain doesn't mean not doing anything about it.
Toughing it out. Yeah. You do something to relieve it. A similar, if not identical, grouping of types of liberation, vimokkha, is to be found in the Visuddhimagga, relating the manner in which each of the familiar three characteristics should be handled and the type of release resulting from that effort. So vimokkha means release, liberation, emancipation. Those are different words for vimokkha. With great resolution, and this is from the Visuddhimagga, with great resolution there is the contemplation of impermanence. This leads to liberation through signlessness, animitta vimokkha. With great tranquility, there is the contemplation of unsatisfactoriness. This leads to liberation through desirelessness, apanahitta vimokkha. So the contemplation of dukkha. With great wisdom, there is the contemplation of selflessness. This leads to liberation through emptiness, sunyata vimokkha. So those doorways into, I think you're thinking in terms of these are tools or skillful means that one utilizes or turns one's attention to, and they tend to produce a particular result, so that contemplation resolving on the contemplation of impermanence, that instability, uncertainty, as Ajahn Chah says, it's unsure. Nature, there is a the mind would tend to liberation through signlessness, in that sense. The mind releases around its tendency to grasp after certain features and characteristics, and getting entangled in the characteristics of things. Say, with great tranquility, is the contemplation of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha, leads to liberation through desireless. Apanahita is desirelessness. So that as one contemplates dukkha, then it tends to cool the mind. That stepping back from passion, passion is a maker of measurement. Passion is a something. Passion is a maker of signs. And so that sense of dispassion or desirelessness, through that contemplation of the willingness to contemplate dukkha, to pick up that sense of that which is unsatisfactory as an object of attention, and say, you know, why do I get swept up in this? Why do I keep getting caught in it? And the mind cools and settles. With great wisdom, there is the contemplation of selflessness, leading to liberation through emptiness, sunyata. So it's again a sense of emphasis that sunyata, being the contemplation, that freedom from self, belonging to a self. These there is a certain analytical tendency to sort of recognizing that especially the five khandhas, what we create identity out of, the sense bases, we create identity out of what we experience through the senses, and so that recognizing that. They're in truth. These are empty. They're not. There's not a substantial me in there that can be isolated somehow. Yeah.
Could you explain again how anicca is related to signlessness?
Well, just sort of seeing the arising and ceasing of things, the ephemeral nature of things, the uncertain nature of things, then you the mind, because to make a sign is to solidify something.
Okay.
To like animita is like you create a sign, an image, an assumption, a solidity, a solid sense of there being something tangible. And you realize, on a conventional level, one has to learn how to live in a world of things, but on a wisdom level, on an insight level, then you can start recognizing the ephemeral nature, the atnimitta nature, the signless quality. We can just move into some space rather than to in a world of things. Yeah.
And it's interesting that the Buddha usually speaks of wholesome qualities in the negative, like non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion.
Yes.
Even the precepts are phrased in the negative.
Yes, yes.
Could you say that that's pointing towards this emptiness?
I never really thought of it like that. One could make a case for it, certainly. But I think it's a bit more prosaic, in the sense of, rather than mandating that you should be generous and kind and selfless all the time, it's just like setting a bar way up here. So, if you can have just non-greed, non-hatred, non-harming, non-dishonesty, you've got a good foundation to work from. any sense?
With particularly with the precepts, where I think it apply, it sort of crosses beyond that.
Yeah.
Neurophysiologically, it's the long word. we respond as human beings more effectively to prohibitions or refraining than we do to activities. So that to say I will refrain from killing living beings has a more potent effect on our actions than I will have love for all living beings. That they're literally different parts of the brain that operate those two kind of following an affirmation and following a prohibition. And so that it seems that the Buddha understood how our minds work, and that in order to actually change the behaviors more effectively, then phrasing things in that like non-cruelty, non-harming, and so forth, those have a more effective way of changing the attitude, changing the behavior, changing the speech, and so on. So if you're interested in the I heard that from a psychology professor called Clifford Sarin. I was at a Buddhist conference on meditation and mindfulness, and he gave this very interesting talk. And they say, and it was like mapping out how, in terms of how behavior, how you act in the world is modified. It's more effective to have those refraining from languaging. That brings more of a change of attitude and more of a change of behavior. So that I feel that's part of it, because again, the Buddha was a very pragmatic teacher, and so rather than an idealistic one, so it was like, well, what's going to make a difference here? And so that languaging of things in terms of non-greed, passionlessness, harmlessness, and so on, that languaging helps to change the attitude, change the behavior more effectively. And Clifford Sarin is his name. If you want to Google that name, you can probably find out some more studies. But I felt that was, because many people have brought that up over the years, that sounds a kind of bit of a negative take on things. So that's a sort of strange way of speaking. Surely, you know, religious teachers should be encouraging, you know, the positive, the bright, the expansive, the glorious. And why did the Buddha, nibbana, cooling down? It's not like ultimate realization of absolute reality, or total bliss for eternity. So anyway, I'm not just saying that it just solely depends on that, but the skill of the Buddha as a teacher and finding ways that genuinely help living beings to be liberated, then he chose that languaging. I feel informed by that what really works most helpfully to shift the view, shift the attitudes and behaviors. It's my pet theory on it.
Yeah. Well, there's three pairs. It looks like we have three pairs: tranquility and suffering. And sorry, I'm going to
get... Yes. Whatever they were.
Is it skillful to direct the mind toward one, or is it a natural sort of one will appear, or a pair will, you know, that will appear?
Our particular temperament will oftentimes make one more interesting than the other. And at different times, so that there might be a predilection by basic kind of temperament toward one or the other. And then at different times, one might lift up different aspects because it seems relevant at the time, so that they're all there to work with, but they are An insight into one will be an insight into all three.
I'm curious about the timeline when the Buddha established or teaching the householder for the five precepts. So any timeline during the Buddha time
That's a good question. You're not the first person to ask that.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a specific, an event. Sometimes in the vignette, there's a time where he established the eight precepts as the form for observing the moon days. That was quite clear, and there's stories that define that. And it's one of the few times that it wasn't because of what somebody said or did. It was just a thought occurring in the Buddha's mind. So very, very occasionally he established structures like the patterns on our robes, the observance of the moon days, the Upasatha, and also the prohibition about eating in the afternoon and evening. That was just sort of out of his own sort of initiative. But for the five precepts, I have looked for it because other people have asked that. And there isn't a very clear incident where he says, this is to be established as a form for the lay community. There isn't like one single sort of occasion where that happens. So you have that for the eight precepts, but not for the five. And that one of the... So in terms of a timeline, there's not, you can't really pin it down, but there's numbers of places where he spells out the five precepts clearly. And one of those, I think, very significant places, I think you were quoting it the other day, is the eight streams of merit, which are sort of respected from ancient times. And it talks about the five precepts as the five great gifts. So the first three of the eight streams of merit are taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And then the last five are the five precepts. And then he speaks about those as streams of merit, the kind of streams of blessing and brightness in the heart. But also he speaks of them as being a gifts to yourself, gifts to others, and gifts to yourself. But there's no kind of distinct moment where he sort of seems to describe it for the first time.
Yeah, I'm just curious, but thinking about lay people go, you know, during the Buddha time, I wonder, are they lay people who go to the Buddha and requesting for the five precepts, like what we do now, or is actually, having this kind of ritual after the Buddha time, you know, that kind of. Curious.
Worthy of curiosity.
Certainly, it seems to be that for the eight precepts, people came to the monastery, to the Arama, and they were deliberately taking on the eight precepts for a day and a night. So, which you have in the sort of one prayer observance in Thailand, is a very strong tradition particularly in the northeast. But the exchange of the three refuges and the five precepts. It's not spelled out as a ritual, as we have it, but in a way that what we have sort of regularly here is like the eight streams of merit. You know, the three refuges and the five precepts. That's the eight streams of merit are being kind of highlighted as a feature, but an actual ritual that occurred in the Buddha's time. Not sure.
Yes, not at all. Not at all. Nothing comes to my mind.
I've looked for it because people have asked that question a few times, and I've sort of done some hunting for the origins of the five precepts and to kind of researching different places. And I've kind of put together a little collection of mentioning of the five precepts in the suttas. And I couldn't track down any. There's certainly nothing in the Vinaya Pitaka, and there's nothing clear in the suttas. is quite so distinct.
And just leading on from that, the eight training precepts that some monastic traditions ask you to take as a layperson when you work, you know, when you're reading the suttas and you're attending Dhamma classes and meditation, is that something that different monastic forms or different Theravada Buddhist forms, because that was something that we were asked to take by Bhante Gunaratna. He always made us take, do the eight training precepts, Ajivattamaka Sila. Is that something much later, depending on preferences of?
I've heard of that. That's certainly from Sri Lanka. Other people who've trained, Venerable Narada Thera also, but that's not a form that you come across in Thailand. Do you know what they?
Yes, so the first four are the same as the five precepts.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the killing and the stealing and the sexual misconduct, and then the fourth is about musavada, which is about lying, and then it's a parusavata, visunavata, and samprapalapa, which is not telling harsh words,
mm-hmm.
divisive words, where you divide two people by telling tales,
mm-hmm.
and also useless chatter, you know, just inconsequential chatter. So, and then did you add on the last one, which is about intoxicants and things. Mm-hmm. So that's how he becomes it. So I remember when Bhante Gunaratna came, because he knows different language, he used to go from West Virginia Monastery very often to Europe to teach meditation in both French and German. And he used to stop in London at the London Buddhist Vihara. And he had quite a lot of Western lay people who were following him. So they requested that they give, because they were in England, whether he could give a retreat in England. And so he did give a retreat for 10 days or something in Gaya House. So it was quite, so there were all these Westerners were there. And I think there were just four of us who were Sri Lankan, because we had met him in London, Buddhist Vihara. And the first thing he told us is that we must observe. He did a lot of things on the Metta Sutta, making us recite it every single day as a form of, you know, a meditation that we should all engage in addition to Samadhi Vipassana. But also, one of the main things he did is he made us all, you know, take on the training.
Yeah, I think it's each Buddhist country tends to develop its own little themes and also lineages, different Nikayas within the country. They have their own particular sort of threads and styles that grow up, and so it's only at that phrase or that grouping I've only come across that with people who've studied with elders from Sri Lanka. So you don't get the same. Okay. I mean, obviously it's compatible, but I see that time has
gone by. Time has gone.